Hello, and welcome to Off the Books, where we're surfing the uncharted waters of accounting, finance, and wherever else the waves take us. I'm Drew Dubner, and I'm your host. I'm not an accountant, but I like asking questions of people who are, so finance professionals can do their jobs better. Today, we have Steve Soder, Camille Rudy, and Ernest Annunciacion. Camille, would you mind jumping in and giving a quick intro of yourself?
Thanks, Drew. Happy to be here. Camille Rudy, National Director of the SEC Professionals Group and the SOX and Internal Controls Professionals Group, ready to talk about working from home, the new norm.
How about you, Steve?
Thank you. My name is Steve Soder, accounting enthusiast and Diet Coke aficionado. Excited to be debiting some introspection as we think about the new normal, and I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
And we've also got Ernest.
Last but not least, this is Ernest Annunciacion. I'm the OG CIA, former chief audit executive and resident internal audit expert. So happy to be on today's episode.
Our topic today, obviously COVID-19 is kind of changing the world we live in. It's obvious to say that it's going to change a lot of things for risk and accounting folks. But, you know, more than what's changing in the future, we know what's changing today. But what about 6 months from now? What's going to change long term? Camille, I'm curious about you especially. If virtual or remote work becomes the new norm, how does that change for the control environment? What does that mean for members of the SOX Professionals Group?
Well, most of our members are used to working in a professional environment in an office where they engage with each other on a regular basis. They have meetings with their peers on a regular basis. And certainly they're used to working with an international workforce as well. So they've had conference calls and email, et cetera. But working from home is quite a challenge. And depending on your home environment, it depends on what the challenge is. Some people are spending a lot more time with their spouses than they ever have before. Some people are dealing with young children at home. Some people are dealing with demanding pets. I'm sure some of you have seen some of the most hysterical memes out there, like the one where the dog is up on the counter saying, "I'm not coming down. I've already had 20 walks today." So, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening out there right now, and the new norm is going to be challenging for everybody. And it's not going to be new for so much longer, Drew.
You know, what does that mean for the world of controls? What does that mean for the day-to-day work of an average SOX person?
Ernest, I'm going to hand this one to you.
Oh, I love a good handoff from the quarterback here, Camille. Drew, I think from the controls environment perspective, I think you're going to see some fundamental changes to risk appetites and what is acceptable. Historically, you might have had, with the luxury of being in person, let's say you had a management review control or an approval control where there might have been six people that were part of that process. And it was very easy to go from desk to desk to desk to desk or to office to office to office and hand the piece of paper around and get everybody's signature. Well, if everybody's remote, it's very difficult to do that. It becomes a much more manual process. It becomes more time intensive in terms of how long the elapsed time can be in terms of gathering all those signatures. So I would challenge people to say, in that instance, and this is a very rudimentary example, I would go back and look at the design of the control and say, do all six people really still need to be part of that process? Can you change delegation of authority limits to offset it and to streamline that process a little bit more? And so, I mean, again, that's a very elementary example of where a control could potentially gain some efficiencies because of remote work and introducing virtual teams. But that's not going to be the case for everything. And so I think, you know, we'll get into some discussions around this a little bit later. But again, that risk appetite may have to open up and look at your controls environment and say, did we over-engineer this potentially?
Ernest, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm curious, in your experience, what percentage of controls relied on physical contact or physical interaction among people for them to operate successfully?
I don't want any physical contact right now. You guys can stay at home.
All right, Steve, to answer your question, whether it be the actual nature of the control itself, So a physical handwritten signature or date timestamp, or if it be some other part of the controls process somewhere down the line, there is a physical element of the control being performed or reviewed or prepared somewhere in between. So the majority of controls, I'd say 90 to 95% of controls, require some sort of physical proximity. Now, there are controls, and people are going to argue, what about IT controls and what about system controls that we have in place? But those controls are only as good as the people that designed those controls and are only as effective and efficient as those who are reviewing the operational effectiveness and the efficiency of those controls. So there's still elements that are manual and still that I'll say are physically required to be performed at either the inception or the tail end of that control and opining on its effectiveness and efficiency.
Well, I ask that question because if what you say is correct, that percentage, and I realize I'm putting you on the spot here for a minute, but if it's true that, you know, 90 to 95% of controls would have some type of physical interaction element of it, then I just wonder, could we say that 95% of what is an accounting process today is now going to somehow change as a result of that, you know, high percentage of physical interaction? I mean, is that, could you draw that conclusion?
I mean, I think there are some transitive properties that are relatable here and that make sense. You know, I would say if you need to physically be part of that process, is that your first indication that this is an opportunity to improve that process or improve that control? Because there are other ways of doing things. There are better technologies that are out there that would help allude to and help gain efficiencies in streamlining through technology.
That's interesting. That's really interesting because I think that that's what a lot of people are going to have found, you know, once we fast forward through this immediate dramatic change of everybody working remotely, is I suspect that where people are going to start, of course, is, hey, what went wrong? What broke? And if it was a process that depended on some physical interaction that then couldn't have happened now because everybody was remote, well, yeah, that's going to be your first indication, as you said, Ernest. Hey, something's wrong. Something needs to be fixed or at least optimized.
I think it's more than what broke. It's that what was unnecessary to begin with? What could have been totally excluded from the process? I know the SEC recently allowed teleconferencing for investor shareholder calls, if I've got that correct. So the SEC is adapting to this and they're the regulatory body that everyone's reporting up into. Why can't companies? Why can't the Big Four? Speaking of the SEC, Steve, are you kind of in the loop with what the SEC is doing to adapt to all this?
Yeah. So, I mean, this shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody who's been paying attention. The SEC has been prolifically releasing revised deadlines and guidance and a few other things. But really what they've said, you know, at least until it gets changed otherwise, is that reports due between the end of March and the 1st of July, for reporting deadlines, you know, those could be extended for up to 45 days. What's interesting is that you don't file a 12B25. You would end up filing an 8K and describing the need to extend the deadline, the reason why, if material, you know, given an updated risk factor related to COVID-19. And I would say that that's somewhat unprecedented. I think the other thing that's been interesting is that the SEC has issued, specifically through the Department of Corporation Finance, or the division rather of Corporation Finance, you know, things to think about as you're making COVID-19 related disclosures. You know, so much of accounting is based on forecasts and estimates. And I would say right now, if you're a brick and mortar retailer, for example, who is classified as non-essential, which means that you've effectively been shut down, at least, you know, until the beginning of May, you know, I'd say that your ability to make those forecasts and judgments and estimates is probably pretty limited right now. Although, you know, something major is going to happen in terms of what you thought your guidance was and what it is now. And I think the SEC has been trying to be informative to people about, hey, these are the things that you should be thinking about I mean, we will see a dramatic fallout, I think, of, you know, as a result of the economy being shut down, at least for a month, if not longer.
And it's not just the SEC guys that that are making changes to kind of accommodate and show empathy for what's going on in the world and everybody kind of playing their part. But we're seeing this with other regulatory bodies, with other federal agencies like the IRS, even extending tax deadlines for individual filers as well as companies. You know, we're starting to see the PCAOB in response to this, providing additional relief from inspections. And then a lot of the banking regulators, to get a little bit more industry specific, we're seeing those banking exams kind of dwindle down in terms of the volume, as well as those extensions of the deadlines. And I think the overall story there, to wrap up, and I think Steve did a nice job providing a little bit more detail and context, but this is all of the cogs and the interdependencies and relationships that keep our global economic system going, right? It's not just me as an individual consumer. It is the companies, whether you're a small brick and mortar or if you're a Fortune 50 multinational conglomerate, all the way up to the regulators. I mean, this system, and to see the regulatory bodies step in and provide some of that that empathy and that time for companies to kind of recuperate, that's very encouraging to see. Now, if I digress from that, though, and get away from all the positive stuff, what I'm wondering, though, in the long run is, hey, that's great that this worked for now, but in the next 9 months, 12 months, 18 months, do we regress back to the mean? And do companies then start to get slapped on the wrist for being so lackadaisical during that time period, or does that become the new norm?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, for me, it's interesting as I think about risk assessments and key controls and other main considerations that we would have for our operating environment and our accounting and finance department. I'm wondering, you know, does readiness for a COVID-19 like event itself become a key control, meaning that, you know, if you're not ready, or maybe if you weren't ready, could that be a deficiency? I mean, you know, if you look at the definition of a material weakness, I mean, it's pretty straightforward, right? There's a reasonable possibility that a material misstatement would not be prevented or detected on a timely basis. So if suddenly all your environment was depending on physical interaction among people, Ernest, as you said, and now that all becomes virtual, could you actually have a material weakness as a result of not being ready for an event like this? I think it's an interesting question.
It sounds plausible, and it sounds kind of scary too. Like, pretty much every public company is going to kind of be experiencing the same sort of thing. And that, do you think, speaking as a non-accountant, that sounds like a lot of companies are going to experience a material weakness because of this. Do you think that's the case?
I mean, from my standpoint, I don't see there being a waterfall, a deluge of material weaknesses. But I think, to Ernest's point, is that right now, where there is clearly and appropriately so, you know, some leniency and you know, giving companies time to work through this. I mean, I just wonder if that, you know, that whipsaw all of a sudden comes back 6 months or 12 months from now, where the ways companies reacted or didn't react suddenly have very real control implications, like at an extreme case, a material weakness. I don't think that's going to happen across the board. I do think it's something that companies are going to need to think about.
Yeah, let's also delineate the difference between a material weakness in the controls and reporting environment versus a material impact to the business. I think every company right now, except for maybe streaming services, are feeling the burdens of this COVID and pandemic crisis in this time. It still remains to be seen in terms of what this means in terms of financial performance. I agree with Steve. It's not going to be a fellow swoop. Everybody has a material misstatement. But what I can see this doing is certain companies taking advantage of these, I guess, what I'll, for lack of a better term, kind of more relaxed times, right? And then do certain individuals take advantage of this to potentially show their companies in a better light than what is truthfully there, right? And that's one of the things when it comes to fraud is having that opportunity kind of present itself. And so that's what I'm interested to see when we fast forward and do a retrospective on this eventually, is to see who kind of takes advantage of that, if at all.
Camille, have you been hearing that from your members of the SEC Professionals Group?
I think there's a lot of uncertainty and people are unsure exactly how they're supposed to be reporting exactly what's happened. And they're unsure about the prognosis for the future and the forecasting and being accurate with everything that they say and do, and specifically regarding disclosures. So yes, I do think there's a lot of uncertainty and fear, and our members always want to do the right thing, and they want to make sure they have all the information that they could possibly have to be as accurate as possible when they report. And so this remote working from home is going to pose a challenge, as well as these relaxed rules, because they're not used to regulators relaxing things. They're used to regulators increasing. So it's the level of uncertainty around all of this is only going to create discomfort around the whole process, I would say. And when you have discomfort and you don't have confidence in the work that you're doing, connecting with people and using technology that you can count on and bank on, that you know will be reliable for you, becomes ever more important.
So we just relaxed, back to your point here, Camille, we just relaxed a bunch of regulations. How do we tighten those back up again if they're needed?
But I think what's different this time is that, I would actually take what Camille said, but I would expand and even increase the sense of urgency there, because I think that, while there was certainly some malintent with, the Enron situation, I think today people are just scrambling just to try to figure out, hey, how do I get my day job done? I think that, to Ernest's point earlier, that results in maybe some suboptimal controls just because they weren't designed for this environment. So things may break. We may see some errors. We may see some things fall apart. And that then drives this sort of new, to your question, Drew, how do we come back from this? I think that's what starts to drive that conversation is, okay, controls were not designed for a totally remote workforce. We got through Q1. But that didn't go as great as we wanted it to. So what does that control environment need to look like in the future? And then it becomes almost this, I'd like to think of it as a renaissance of, virtually operating controls in order to accomplish the very things that they were designed in the first place, just not designed to do remote or with a virtual workforce, at least from my perspective. I think the conversation turns to controls in a big way, but that's not going to be for, what, maybe 45 to 60 days.
And that's enough with that. Thanks, Steve. We're going to take a quick break. Going to go run a commercial. Be back to the conversation in a minute. Today's episode is brought to you by Workiva. In case you haven't noticed, we're all working from home, and our kids are shooting Nerf guns at us while we're presenting to the audit committee. And we've reorganized the pantry like 14 times since we're all procrastinating on the real things that need to get done. Do you really need work to be another stressor? I don't think so. Workiva helps risk and reporting teams work collaboratively by housing all critical documents, spreadsheets, and presentations in one spot. No more shared drives or buggy VPNs. Everything you need is right there, so you get more time to organize your sock drawer again or beat your kid in a game of Stratego for the 10th time this week. And we're back. So, Steve, Ernest, Camille, prior to the break, we talked about what's changing like way off on the horizon, 6 months, 8 months down the road, the SEC, all this stuff that's very integral to the industry that's changing. But, what's not going to change? So we emerge from this in May or June or whenever the president is telling us we can leave the front door again. What's going to be the same about the future going forward from here?
Well, I think from my standpoint, I have recognized again that I still love my kids very much. and I find them just as annoying now as I did at the beginning of all this. I think it's interesting to see the way that work has adapted, and at the end of the day, we still have deadlines, we still have to close the books, we still have to get our stuff done. Now we just do it in this large petri dish of homeschooling and work from home and conference calls, and everybody wants to go outside and we can't. And I don't think those types of stresses, while they may have appeared and manifested themselves differently, I don't think that's any different than it has ever been or it ever will be.
Yeah, and for me, I don't think this notion of remote work or virtual work for auditors is really that big of a departure from what they're historically used to. Unlike your accounting or financial reporting teams, internal audit, risk management professionals, you know, those second and third lines of defense are usually off in their own little corner of the building. And so they already had a level of physical proximity removed from being part of the greater, let's say, CFO organization or operational organization. So now by working from home, you do add another layer of complexity when it comes to how do you build rapport and how do you build credibility with your audit clients. But that's not anything new to the internal audit profession. In fact, risk management professionals were built for this sort of thing in terms of their adaptability and in terms of being able to identify and prioritize risks that were coming on. So I really don't, if anything, I think this is going to be an opportunity for the profession to really step up its game when it comes to helping fortify the resiliency of your individual organizations. So whether that's testing your business continuity plans or redrafting a disaster recovery plan or, you know, providing advice on your crisis management plan, I mean, this is a time where internal audit can truly add value. It's not just focusing on the things that always have to get done. We know that you're always going to have to comply with SOX. You're always going to have external audit there, right? But focus really on the things that the business deem critical at this point, both in the short term.
So what about, what does that mean for the community? And this is kind of esoteric, I admit that. But like, what does that mean for the community of audit and the community of accountants? Like, Ernest, you and I have tagged along to a number of those IAA events before. Like, it's so great to be able to collect with people and just chat and learn from people. So does that mean the community of audit just kind of evaporates, or is it evolve into something else?
Never. I mean, no, I don't see that ever going away. Auditors have been around ever since the inception of business. And, you know, if anything, hopefully it helps to build confidence within the audit profession and knowing what the true value add of an auditor is. That connectivity that you're talking about, Drew, and those connections that you build, we can't get lost. And hopefully that's one thing that, you know, I was looking through social media the other night, and a very good question was framed as, what is it that you took for granted 2 weeks ago that you missed the most? And some of the basic things, like going to meet up with my dad for coffee, or going to see this person or that. I mean, that just reinforces that need for that human contact. It doesn't necessarily always have to be physical, but it's very difficult to build relationships when you can't establish that rapport and that credibility with somebody, which you can't replicate without being face to face. And in fact, that's something that I demanded my audit teams in the past, was that, hey, go take your audit client out on a date. And by that, I meant go take them to lunch, go take them out to coffee, go grab some ice cream, like get to know them as a human being first before you start talking about them as a process or a control owner or whatever their title was in the company.
Note to self, date coworkers.
Well, how about this, Drew? I mean, wasn't it Woody Allen that said, you know, 90% of life is showing up, being there in person, connecting with people? That's where the credibility and the relationship develops and gets nurtured.
But on that note, I would say, Camille, we have seen really an increase in the need and want and desire for people to connect. within the pro groups. There's some isolation that goes, you know, oddly enough, stuck in a house with kids and pets and spouses and partners. It can sometimes feel really isolating. And I mean, Camille, we've seen that, haven't we?
Yes, absolutely. We certainly have.
And, you know, it's interesting, Ernest, that you brought up kind of that demand for, you know, your auditors to date their clients. You know, I had the same policy, but just the reverse, that I actually demanded those dates. I was a very demanding significant other in that I wanted to have those discussions and have the auditors understand what it was that I was going through and what challenges were on the horizon. So in some of the most successful auditing relationships that I had, we had a standing Friday lunch, and I'd say we'd probably cancel it, I don't know, 50% to two thirds of the time. But the very fact that we had prioritized that connection in order for us to be able to develop that rapport, share that understanding of where our risks were and where the auditor saw the risk, I think made it go so much easier. And ultimately, I think it actually reduced cost, because we weren't kind of spinning wheels and going rounds on things that were changing or new transactions or something that was different. We had that rapport to where I could give them a, you know, a heads up in advance. They could make adjustments on the fly accordingly so that we weren't caught flat-footed. And it really made for a much, much more effective, efficient, and again, I think cost-effective relationship.
I can't speak for myself. I don't have any kids, but you all just talked about kids and or very childish things. So what are you doing to keep them sane right now?
Well, my number one job is to keep my son alive, because he is only 17 months and has quickly discovered that he is also not just a human being, but also part primate, and has turned into a little monkey that likes to climb on everything, especially things that he can't climb on top of.
Already at 17 months, he's doing that?
Yeah, I think it runs in the family, Camille.
You mean you or your wife?
I'll let you be the judge.
Steve, how much silly putty do your kids have?
Well, you know, we have a handful. And for our part, we have found that trying as hard as we can to stick to a normal routine, while it feels very inconvenient to still be waking up super early when you realize that, you know, we don't have a school bus to catch or early morning band practice, it has actually helped. We've got five, our oldest is 16, our youngest is turning 10 this year. And so it's a little bit different than Ernest, but I think sticking to routines has been helpful. What's hard is that it's not as easy for them to connect socially as it is for me as an adult, meaning that I'm on video conferences all the time, FaceTime chats, whatever. With the kids, it's a little bit different, and I actually feel bad for, you know, kind of that lack of connection that they would normally get through school. So we've been doing our best to try to make up for that as a family, and it's actually gone quite well. I'd say that we have drawn closer together. We're less impacted by kind of outward distractions, whether it's extracurricular activities or, you know, other things like that. And so from that standpoint, it's been nice. It's been kind of an unforeseen but very nice consequence of all of this. Hey, and on a positive note, our chicken started laying eggs again, which was totally unexpected and super awesome, because eggs are hard to find at the grocery store.
Let's wrap things up in the conversation with one question. Steve, what's the one thing that you're working on, personal development, in quarantine? Go.
Silly putty sculpting.
Ernest, what are you feeling? Are you trying to beat Zelda Ocarina of Time for the 15th time?
Actually, I went all the way back to A Link to the Past.
Oh, good choice.
I know this is going to sound very cliche, but I am also catching up on reading.
Camille, what are you working on?
Well, I just finished a book that I thoroughly enjoyed. And as you asked this question, I realized that my closets are begging for attention. So that's going to be on my list of to-dos.
Get to work. I love it. Well, that's enough of a cluster cluck. Steve, thanks so much. Ernest, thanks so much. Camille, thank you even more. Surf's up, everybody. Looking forward to the next conversation. Have a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, but what percentage of it can you actually use is the real question.
No, the real question is, are you really cleaning your closet out, Camille?
Oh, it's, you have no idea, Ernest. I need to. I mean, I really do. I have so many clothes.
1 year rule. If you haven't worn it in a year, get rid of it.
Marie Kondo.
Yeah.
Hey, Camille, what's the status of the Big Bird sweater? Are you busting that out and I just don't see it? It's been a while.
I've worn it since my birthday. That's right. I should pull it out.